The Mysteries of Watergate, Episode 33, Watergate Journalism, The Seeds of Our Discontent.
I want to talk to you tonight from my heart on a subject of deep concern to every American.
Those who hate you don't win unless you hate them.
I've been charged with involvement.
A full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
What has come to be known as the Watergate Affair.
Hello. I'm John O'Connor, your author of the book Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. We have shown in our earlier episodes that the Post's Watergate reporting was thoroughly untruthful, and also that it was a substantial causative factor in an earth-shaking series of developments so impactful to our country's history, not the least of which was the removal of a successful president overwhelmingly reelected. Put more simply, if the reporting was essentially untruthful, the will of the people in our democracy was subverted by Post journalism. We have explained at the beginning of this section of our podcast that fraud is not limited to affirmative misrepresentations, but also includes perhaps the more widespread practice of simply omitting inconvenient facts. We have presented the hypothetical case in which a seller of land is asked by a prospective buyer whether the back 40 has plenty of water for his planned farming. The seller tells him truthfully that there's plenty of water year-round with a well of only 20 feet. But by omitting his knowledge that the water table is polluted with toxins, the seller is committing fraud. In partial defense of this type of fraud, it is clear that many people do not realize that this type of suppression or concealment in fact is fraud, and it may well be that most journalists do not think of this as fraud either. We note that especially in recent years, in aid of a superficially determined storyline favoring the journalist's chosen cause, inconvenient facts are routinely omitted. Let us give two examples. A prominent recent example of widespread journalistic dishonesty is the failure of the major media to report on or deeply analyze confounding facts in the so-called Russiagate investigation of presidential candidate and then President Donald Trump. I will not delve into this deeply, but will give you one example. Any journalist with half a brain could see that one Sergey Milyan was supposed to be a major witness with knowledge both of the doings of the Trump campaign and the Kremlin in aid thereof, and if so, something was amiss. After all, Sergey Milyan was a nobody living on Astoria Avenue in the Queens, probably a lower-level Soviet intelligence asset, and indeed so investigated by the Justice Department. Another recent example is the Hunter Biden laptop non-reporting. Asking how major media companies could actively suppress such an important story with such clear, factual foundation can only yield troubling answers. But, still and yet, I sense that most journalists doing so do not believe they were dishonest, deceitful, fraudulent. They do not believe they were intentionally subverting our democracy. If that is the case, even if Watergate journalism's success is the cause of this shoddy partisan journalism, does it make a difference if the Post was indeed acting willfully, falsely, in essence what we would call a form of criminal intent? Again, there is no such true crime as false reporting, and I'm using that term by analogy. But our question is whether intentional deception of the public in Watergate would make a difference as opposed to simply negligent failure to report the facts truthfully. I here submit that it does. After all, the success of the Post reporting was inspiration for and proof of concept of today's partisan journalism. This type of scandal journalism could not have survived if not for the Post Watergate journalism. Note that every political scandal since 1972 has had a, quote, gate, unquote, attached to its name, and many occurrences that should have had a gate so attached were shielded by the refusal to add the gate suffix, in other words, by clearly partisan reporting. Let's look at this another way. If in an alternative history world, the Post would have reported about the CIA's White House infiltrations, the escort service, the lack of campaign connection, Nixon likely would have finished his term, as did Bill Clinton, tarnished somewhat, but little worse for the wear. So-called investigative journalism never would have been born, at least in the form that it now takes. Muckraking may well have stayed in the shadows as it was previously, and our society less politicized by partisan journalism. On the other hand, if the Post willfully, persistently, and actively altered the truth, the Post must be held accountable for this practiced deceit and shamed more deeply than Nixon. We know how society today is roiled by partisan journalism, helping to cause a divided tribal country. How much of this was fraudulently caused by the Post and Watergate? So if done willfully and fraudulently, it was the Post who planted the seeds of our discontent. So was the Post reporting deliberately deceitful? I think we have shown in spades this fact, but let's sum up why the Post had to do so and did do so fraudulently. Immediately following the burglary arrests, Watergate quickly presented a binary choice for the Post. On the one hand, the obvious circumstances promised a clean shot at the hated Nixon and in favor of the Democratic Party. The Post was proud to represent itself to be founded as the official paper of the Democratic Party in 1877. On the other hand, perhaps within days, perhaps right away, the paper realized the finger would soon be pointed away from the White House and toward the Democrats and the CIA. Post editor Ben Bradley perhaps had been a CIA asset when he was a foreign correspondent, in any case, was very close to longtime CIA director Alan Dulles, and to a lesser extent, close with present CIA director Richard Helms. The CIA was a very Ivy League secret society sort of outfit, in contrast to the middle-class Catholic FBI. So the Post would naturally have been motivated not only to skewer the Republican enemy Nixon, but also to protect the CIA along with the favored Democratic Party. The Post staff, of course, quickly saw the obvious potential political campaign connection to the burglary. It was summer 1972, and a hotly contested presidential campaign loomed. The burglary had obvious CRP connections through its security director, McCord. In just a day, Post reporters learned the connection to the burglars of Howard Hunt, a White House consultant. His name and White House number appeared in an address book found in a burglar's hotel room, along with a $6.36 check of Hunt to a nearby country club. So it was clear that there was a potential, quote, storyline, unquote, about the connection of the burglary to the Nixon campaign. I use the term, quote, storyline, unquote, advisedly, because one hears journalists speaking this way about an emerging subject. As a litigation lawyer, however, I shudder when I hear it. I do so because it seems to put the narrative cart before the factual horse. A litigator will usually not construct a narrative until he knows that there are sufficient facts to support it in the face of contrary argument, enough at least in order to support one's case in front of a jury or a judge. On the other hand, the phrase, quote, storyline, unquote, implies that all future information gained will be bent and twisted to fit the earlier envisioned line of the narrative. When Jeb Magruder was asked how it was decided by the Nixon team to cover up the burglary, he responded that there was never any thought expressed or discussion about that there would not be a cover-up. It seems that this may have been the case as well with the Post. Certainly, all Post reporters and editors were quite aware of the paper's traditional allegiance to the Democratic Party. With that in mind, the scene initially confronted by Post reporters had to be discomforting. A brief surveillance would show that, apart from the removed ceiling tile and smoke detector near O'Brien's office, all the activities occurred in a part of the offices that did not even belong to the DNC. Rather, the open drawer, camera clamps, and several burglars were in the space occupied by the Association of Democratic Chairmen, whose head was Spencer Oliver Jr., and his secretary was Ida Maxie Wells. This fact alone would seem to defeat any claim of a political campaign connection, since Oliver and Wells had little to do with it, if anything. These facts alone would have been disconcerting and potentially in conflict with an obvious Republican versus Democrat, quote, storyline, unquote, suggested by the activity in and around the office of DNC Director Lawrence O'Brien. Of course, the dramatic struggle between Officer Carl Schauffler and burglar Eugenio Martinez over a desk key was potential dynamite, which at least would blow up the possible narrative of political rivalry and perhaps as well hurt the Democrats. After all, if not looking for dirt, why would the burglars be there? And what would the dirt be? If dealing with Oliver and Wells, it would not likely be campaign dirt. To be sure, at the time of the first story, we cannot impute any knowledge to the Post affirming scandalous secrets of the Democrats, but certainly the reporters were cautious enough not to mention the Oliver/Wells/ADC connection. Nothing good could come of that. So the failure of the Post at the outset to report the location of most mischief and the identities of the affected occupants would suggest at least a wariness among Post staff about uncovering unfavorable truths, if not an intent to cover up. That Monday, June 20, in a story likely sourced no later than Sunday, June 19, Woodstein casually inserted a note in a larger story alluding to the possibility of a sixth participant. This bare-bones allusion, with no description of the man or the circumstances of his discovery, again suggests at least a diffidence about revealing a fact that could harm the Democrats. After all, they knew more about his dress, his escape, and his likely lurking either on the sixth floor or the eighth floor than they reported. Please recall that the paper never mentioned the tape remaining on the locks, especially the odd placement of same on the locks of the eighth floor. We cannot say that as of the printing of this story early Monday morning, June 20, that the Post knew the specifics of what it was actually covering up by its reticence in revealing these details. In fact, we infer that as of early Monday, June 20, the Post did not yet put all the pieces together. Why do we say this? Because the June 20 article did reveal the sixth participant, even though without the details. It would not later make that mistake and would suppress any further mention of this sixth participant, sometimes known as the sixth burglar. This passing reference was the last time the Post pursued this touchy subject, which later included avoidance of any mention of Lou Russell. It would then be our conclusion that the paper had already decided upon its overall storyline, but not necessarily the confounding facts it would need to cover up by hook or by crook. Now, earlier I used the date June 20 as being Monday morning. Monday morning, in fact, was June 19, 1972. It was on that day that the Democrats sued the Republican Committee to re-elect the president, suggesting a political motive. For this reason, we think the Post had that storyline in mind, as at least of that date. The firm so filing this case was Williams, Connolly, and Califano, with, of course, Joseph Califano also serving as the Post general counsel. So we posit that the Post had the storyline, just not an understanding of the inconvenient facts. It is highly likely, though, that early that week, the Post began to understand how certain facts were in fact inconvenient. We know that the Democrats and Joseph Califano's law firm would have been grossly negligent if they did not immediately find out what was in the desk that the burglars were so interested in. At some time during that first week, the Democratic headquarters were searched by the FBI to determine which desk fit the key. Sometime that week, they did determine that the desk belonged to Maxie Wells. The FBI did not come into the office to interview Wells and her successor, Barbara Kennedy Roden, until June 27, a week later. By this time, Wells had already resigned and Roden assigned to replace her. So it is likely that the Post knew sometime in that first week of the escort referral practice. Would Joseph Califano hide this explosive fact from the Post? It is incomprehensible that he would do this as its general counsel. On June 27, as the FBI was interviewing Wells and Roden, Woodstein published a cryptic reference that the Democrats believe there had been earlier surveillance in the weeks before the attempted burglary, subject to the arrest. As we have noted, this item meant that Cassadino had been talking to Califano about Baldwin's story. We know that the Republicans refused representation of Baldwin around June 24, and by June 27, it is likely that Baldwin would have already had representation by Cassadino, and Cassadino would have debriefed him. Cassadino certainly would have interrogated Baldwin about the purpose of the surveillance, which would include much overhearing of what Baldwin would later describe as sounding to most people like prostitution, absent the prices. So, putting Wells and Baldwin together, the Post and the Democratic Party certainly knew of the lured talk and prostitute referrals, and just as clearly knew they had to quash any revelations about that. Now, what about the CIA's role in this burglary? Around June 27, Woodstein reported the story that Mullen lawyer Douglas Caddy had told the prosecutors, who repeated same in open court, that he had, quote, intimations, unquote, that Mullen had connections to the CIA. But is this all that the Post knew about the CIA, explained lamely by Robert Bennett as likely referring to Mullen's work for Radio Free Cuba in the 1960s? No, it is extremely likely that at least by this time, likely sooner, the paper knew that the CIA was in this up to its eyeballs. Why can we so conclude? We know that on Wednesday, June 21, 1972, Mark Felt advised his boss, Patrick Gray, that the burglary was a White House job, a CIA job, or both. It was the same day that Felt received a confidential CIA memo revealing the Mullen cover contract. We also know that by the time of Bennett's July 10, 1972 debriefing by his handler, Eisenstadt, that he had made a deal with Woodward to protect Mullen, meaning, of course, cover contract, in turn meaning Hunt's near-certain undercover status. The Post knew this well before July 10, in other words. Because Bennett had been a source of Woodward since early in the burglary's wake, as we have shown, it is highly likely that this, quote, deal, unquote, would have been made in that first week post-burglary. Woodward and Bennett, in short, knew that they both shared aligned incentives. Recall Woodward's sincere profession that Deep Throat would never be untrue to him, as he said in All the President's Men. Felt was available to confirm that Woodward was on the right track if looking to the CIA. We assume Woodward did in fact learn of the CIA connection from Felt and inquired of Bennett about it. But in any case, he and Bennett, we know, discussed it. So however the first knowledge was gained, the Post knew very quickly about the CIA, we can be fairly certain. Now the past CIA connections of the burglars through the Bay of Pigs and McCord's career with the CIA loomed large. The Post had all it needed to finger the CIA if it so wished. Of course, we now know it did not. So let's summarize the Post knowledge as of late June 1972. In short, it knew it all. Indeed, given its knowledge of what Maxie Wells was up to on Oliver's phone, it knew more than the FBI, and as well learned of what Baldwin had to say long before the FBI did, or a few days before in any case, and likely knew more about the details than Baldwin would give to the FBI. The FBI, of course, knew it was unethical to blab what it knew to the press. The more harmful, the less wise to reveal. So the public would learn of the FBI's knowledge only to the extent Felt's outlet Woodward wished to publish it. Now let's look at Nixon. History has assumed that the conspirators in the Oval Office knew all from the outset. Not so. The group knew there was a burglary paid for by Liddy and supervised by Hunt, and that the fruits were worthless personal gossip. But the individual sponsor was unknown, and the purpose of this odd burglary was unknown. In short, these officials knew very, very little. Recall that Dean and Magruder, especially Dean, were acting innocent. Magruder was not forthcoming, and Liddy was not talking at all, nor were Hunt and McCord in any line of communication with the White House. So the White House, for the most part, was in the dark. In short, the Post was in complete control of this story. Only this paper had an intimate relationship with the DNC, and only Woodward had Deep Throat as a source. And only the Post, through Lewis and others, had close, intimate connection with the local police. Other papers had no presence and involvement for many months. Unfortunately, power corrupts, and the Post had power over this story completely. Let's go back to our analogy used by Plato, perhaps better termed a metaphor. When one is invisible, one is likely to be immoral. Unlike today, where a regional paper might get resonance from the internet, cable television, or talk radio, a local or regional paper would likely get only limited circulation in 1972. So the Post, as the story's acknowledged steward and proprietor, could with impunity simply fail to republish any such reporting if it so wished, and keep that regional or local story out of the main Watergate narrative. And the brief nightly news shows on the major channels were very staid presentations, unlikely to hype any scandal. So yes, the Post narrative would face perhaps some challenge with a local or regional story, but the Post could likely deal with any such reporting simply by omitting it and ignoring it. The Post also knew of the possibility that it could distort or ignore revelations in the public record. That said, spectacular revelations in a court setting constituted the most formidable challenge to the Post's narrative. So let's jump ahead and carry out our thesis about how the Post could and would control this story. Three blockbuster newspaper stories, two in May of 1973 in Chicago Today about Stevens, and one in the Washington Star News about Russell in October 1972, were simply ignored by the Post while overshadowed by contemporaneous sensational exposés of the Post. One such expose that drowned out the Russell story was the spying and sabotage story about the Segretti program, which was sourced through the all-night Deep Throat Woodward meeting. So Pat Collins' great story about Russell was essentially drowned out. The same can be said of the May 1973 reporting of what Dean, Magruder, and McCord were now revealing as newly minted witnesses. These sensational stories easily blocked out the Chicago Today stories about Stevens. And of course, at this point, it is beyond doubt that the Post suppressed Deep Throat's story about CIA death threats to hide CIA involvement, not only in Watergate, but in other illegal operations. The Post ignored the blackmail dialogue in two major court proceedings in January 1973, one before Sirica during trial and one before Bazelon and his appeals panel a week later. The blackmail colloquy was clearly the most interesting and indeed the most central part of each proceeding, yet the Post published not a word. The Baltimore Sun mentioned the term blackmail in one report, and of course it had no understanding of what kind of blackmail would be postulated. But the Post, had they covered this idea, knew well what the blackmail was about. The Post knew that the putative victim of the blackmail, Spencer Oliver, was a minor official not connected to the campaign, so simply reporting the blackmail would have revealed both the salacious nature of the conversations overheard and the fact that this had nothing to do with the campaign. So the Post reported nothing about the blackmail and certainly did not flesh out the bare-bones story of the Baltimore Sun mentioning blackmail in the arguments. As we have noted, the Stevens stories from Chicago Today, if reprinted in the Post with appropriate placement and headline, would have been a bombshell that turned Watergate on its head. The Post suppressed the story precisely, we infer, because it was the Post narrative that the Post would have destroyed if it were honest. Are there set-in-stone markers to show with definitive proof of the intentionality of the paper, that is to say, its guilty mind? Yes, there are. The Silbert hearings of spring 1974 fulsomely featured the CIA defense, blackmail, and the embarrassing sexual dirt. So the failures of the Post to report the Silbert hearings in any detail is one such marker of intent. And of course, the fundamental mischaracterizations of the fact-packed Baker report is a big strike too on the Post. Its recounting of the report by the respected minority chairman of the Watergate Committee is nothing short of deceitful and fraudulent. Strike three must be called on Woodward's dishonest review of Will, the Liddy autobiography. Most people would not understand, for instance, the significance of Liddy's belief that the $30,000 he paid to McCord for a super sophisticated room bug for O'Brien had actually been implanted in O'Brien's furniture in the first burglary. A portion of this money was paid, it seems, to Stevens for bugs uplinking to a CIA satellite. But regarding the $30,000 bug of which Liddy wrote, Woodward was one of the few people who knew of its true place in the story and how it would show both a secret CIA agenda and also that the burglaries were not about political campaigns. So even if Post advocates can make unduly favorable assumptions one after another about many areas of untrue reporting, these three items are incapable of honest explanation. So we therefore can safely conclude that the Post played a substantial part in deliberately and dishonestly driving Nixon from office, and that its very major role in doing so was dishonestly informing the public about this important matter. Some may say, so what? We all know the media are dishonest. But most today do not have the historical memory to blame this on the Post. It was the Post's journalism in Watergate that gave birth to the dishonest reporting we have today. To be fair, many, perhaps most journalists today do not think of the Post reporting as fraudulent. They assume it was excellent and truthful. So how can we say that the Post caused today's blatant dishonesty? The Post reporters have been widely praised over the years for refusal to take the White House at its word. The unstated belief being that, especially if a conservative president is stating his innocence, he will eventually be proven a liar. This was one of the takeaways of the Post Watergate reporting. It is fair to conclude that the presumption of conservative guilt was introduced during Watergate. The more problematic development is the widespread media belief that there is nothing wrong with simply failing to state a particular fact. As we have explained, if the fact so concealed is one that would bear upon the statements actually made by the media outlet, that is fraud. Such fraud is now commonplace. Even more of a problem stemming from the Post's so-called success in Watergate comes from the current sense among journalists that it is the proper role of such journalists to affect outcomes. We can then draw a straight line from Watergate to the 2020 election, when a major media outlet buried the highly significant Hunter Biden laptop story. 9% of Biden voters said that had they known of this story, they would have reconsidered their votes. To say that our democracy is deeply in danger from this suppression of news is an understatement. But more disturbing is that this state of affairs will not be easy to turn around. After thousands of young college graduates inspired by Woodstein's reporting flocked to journalism schools, surveys showed that their main motivation was to change the world. And if these young, idealistic students wished to change the world, they would most likely be on the side of leftist change. The word conservative does not connote an urge to radical reform. And to change the world, one should not be even-handed. Journalists of such a mind will likely not disclose all inconvenient facts or discuss them fairly. The very honest far-left journalist Matt Taibbi notes that this new breed wants to be part of the ruling elite, going behind the velvet rope with the powerful. This is a distinct change from those rumpled reporters who viscerally distrusted all elites prior to Watergate. Even left-leaning traditional muckrakers like Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson did not hesitate to hit left-leaning corruption targets. Not so today. Perhaps more concerning, media outlets, perhaps most, have learned that strong partisan stances attract profitable partisan eyeballs. How much profit has been earned by media outlets, by partisan focus, pro or con, on Donald Trump? How can this sad state of affairs be remedied? Every time there is a potential scandal, typically one implicating a conservative politician, inevitably Carl Bernstein and/or John Dean will declare the scandal, quote, worse than Watergate, unquote. So it would aid this situation if one concept could be implanted in the public psyche. From here on out, quote, worse than Watergate, unquote, should now have new meaning and apply to dishonest journalism. First step in knocking shameful dishonesty off its fraudulently won perch is to recognize the dishonesty of Watergate journalism. Only then can our society begin to heal and honestly, with humility and grace, discuss our differences. We should have enough of a media that profits through name-calling and invective. The Post's responsibility for today's media dishonesty is perhaps the most important lesson we learn when we solve the mysteries of Watergate. Thank you for listening. I have just completed a book on the same subject entitled The Mysteries of Watergate: What Really Happened. While it covers the material in our podcast, I have added 2 chapters of contextual materials and remove the repetition needed for a podcast. For those enjoying this series, it will serve as a valuable historical reference. For your non-listening friends, it will prove enlightening and entertaining. Thank you for your support.